You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, dating is weird these days, but science can help. The author of a new book shares advice on navigating the new world of dating with lessons from the behavioral sciences. Now, the federal deficit is projected to hit $2.3 trillion this fiscal year. That's smaller than the record $3.1 trillion last year, but according to the Congressional Budget Office, it would still surpass 10% of the overall economy. That would make it the second largest deficit proportionally since World War II. That doesn't include the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill that the House is planning to vote on tomorrow. Meanwhile, the federal debt, that's the sum of annual deficits, it's expected to reach 102% of GDP by the end of this year, 107% in 10 years. Our next guest says those numbers mean that the COVID bill needs some work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about the annual deficit, the overall debt? What do you think should be done about it? Should Congress pass the COVID relief bill as is, or do you worry that it's too expensive? What questions do you have about federal spending or revenue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Goldwine is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about how we got here in budget numbers. First of all, pre-COVID, we had a thing where the economy was going up, but our deficit was going up, which I think is a little weird. What was happening there before this huge COVID thing hit us?
Yeah, this really was an aberration. Through most of our history, when the economy's been doing well, we've been reducing deficits, both because strong growth means strong revenue and because policymakers took the opportunity to cut spending and raise taxes if necessary. This time around, we cut taxes and we raised spending during recovery. And so we were facing trillion-dollar annual deficits before the COVID crisis even started.
And then here comes COVID. And of course, there's a hit on both those sides you just talked about. Our revenues go down because a lot of businesses were just flat out closed. And then the demand for a lot of things, food stamps and things like that goes up, and the COVID aid packages. Talk about the hit that had when it came to our deficit last year.
That's exactly right. The economy took a big hit, and that did affect the deficit. But really, the big effect was we've passed so far about $3.5 trillion worth of COVID relief. And that's really expensive. And that's the reason we ended up with record high deficits last year and deficits that are going to be sort of a number two record this year.
And now, as you look at this new package supported by President Biden and Democrats, most of them in Congress, it looks like, what are your concerns about the amount of spending and the kinds of spending you're seeing in this package?
Sure. Well, I think we should spend whatever is necessary to get through this crisis. Any dollar spent to end the pandemic sooner is worthwhile. And now's not the time to be skittish about borrowing to help the economy recover. The issue with this package is it seems like it spends way more than what is needed, and not just a little bit more, maybe about three times as much as what's needed to bring the economy into recovery. And a lot of that money is going to states and localities that don't need it, to households that have actually seen their incomes grow, or for policies like a pension bailout that have nothing to do with COVID relief at all.
Yeah, which particular parts would you want to keep? What do you look at and say, okay, this is money that is well spent, even if it does bring up the deficit this year?
So the money spent on vaccines, on testing and tracing, on making sure that PPE is funded and schools can reopen, that's worthwhile. The money spent to extend unemployment benefits, which a lot of people are going to lose by the middle of next month to early April. That's worthwhile, although I would make some adjustments. The money spent on housing assistance, on nutrition, that money makes a lot of sense. Where I get a little tied up is the huge amounts of money spent on checks. And while I do think we need to send some money to states and localities, especially those that are hurting, like Alaska and Hawaii and Florida and Nevada, we don't need to spend $500 billion on state and local aid.
Right. I know you focus on the federal budget, but there was a big concern that states and local governments were going to face a huge crunch, declining sales taxes, more expenses during COVID. What have we seen panning out for most state governments at this point?
So what we saw, states did face a huge crunch in the spring of last year. And for some states, again, like the ones I named, states that are reliant on tourism or oil prices, that crunch has remained. But for most states, their revenue is pretty much recovered or close to recovered to pre-pandemic levels. Meanwhile, we've already actually offered about $350 billion of federal aid, either to the states and localities directly, or to schools or transit authorities, other things that are public run. And so there still is some need, but it's not nearly as bad as what we thought it was going to be a few months ago.
Talking to Mark Goldwine from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget about a big jump in our annual deficit, especially during COVID, a big jump in our overall national debt. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Mark, spell out for us the damage you worry about if we have these huge deficits.
So there's sort of these near-term risks and there's these long-term costs. In the near term, there's a small but significant risk that we're going to spend so much that we will either cause high levels of inflation or, and this would be kind of ironic, we will juice the economy so much that jobs will be at an unsustainable level. We'll have such good employment that the only thing that can follow is a crash. And so I do worry that we overjuice the economy. Either we get inflation or we get sort of a spike in a crash. That's a near-term concern. I think that the chance of either of those happening is less than 50%, but you know, maybe more than a quarter. So it's something worth considering. Over the long term, if we continue to borrow at this current pace, not just for COVID, but for our core spending, which is well in excess of our revenue and growing, it slows economic growth and reduces income. Basically, every dollar that somebody spends buying a government bond is a dollar they're not otherwise putting into the economy, either by spending it, by buying stocks, by putting it in the bank that can then relend it. And over time, that starts to eat away at our economic growth. Maybe the Congressional Budget Office thinks about 0.2% per year. 0.2% is not that big a deal over just 1 year. But when it happens every year over and over again, it starts to really eat at income. And it means that 30 years from now, you know, per person income could be $7,000 lower than it otherwise would be.
Let's look at a post-COVID world, which is hopefully sooner than later. How would you like to see government, Congress, and the White House tackle spending, given that, you know, there's one party that really doesn't want to raise taxes, one party that doesn't really want to cut spending, and some sort of sacred cows out there that are hard to do either way? What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, look, so we don't need to balance the budget, but we can't be running trillion-dollar deficits indefinitely. I think the place to start is let's get our major trust funds under control. Our highway trust fund is projected to run out of money by 2022, next year. The Medicare trust fund by 2026 or so. The Social Security trust funds, both the disability and old age, in the early 2030s. So let's start by saving those programs. And yes, it's going to mean some people are going to pay more taxes, maybe more gas tax or more payroll tax. And yes, it's going to mean that benefits for some of these programs are going to grow a little bit more slowly, and some medical providers are going to get reimbursed a little bit differently or a little bit less. But the good news is we're going to make these programs solvent, so there's no immediate across-the-board cuts, which is what calls for under current law. If we could make those trust funds solvent, all four of those big trust funds, we'd go a long way towards getting our debt under control, and we'd do it while getting something else in return.
We're talking about the federal deficit and what Washington could do to shrink it with Mark Goldwine. He's Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the deficit? What, if anything, would you like to see done about it? When you look at a new COVID relief package, do you think going big is needed now in still tough times for some people, or do you think it should be pared back? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking a look at the federal deficit. Earlier this month, the Congressional Budget Office projected a deficit of $2.3 trillion this fiscal year. It's a big one, and that doesn't count the COVID relief bill set to be voted on in the House tomorrow. Mark Goldwine is Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Rebecca?
Well, there's 2 points. One, the COVID bill, as you keep mentioning, should be just COVID relief for our people if it's going to be there. There should not be any earmarks for any corporations, for other countries. We need to stop doing that. We need to stop supporting all these other countries as long as our country has got a deficit. We shouldn't be spending millions and billions of dollars to other countries. And secondly, the unemployment. Those of us who are self-employed, we don't get anything extra. In fact, we took a hit this year. While those that are getting unemployment, I would like to know what genius came up with the idea of giving them $600 extra a week. That was ridiculous. I understand maybe giving them what they would normally get on a weekly wage. That would have made sense. But an additional $2,400 a month when they're not working, when those of us who are still working got nothing extra, and those of us who are self-employed, the farmers, we get nothing extra.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for the call. Gave us a lot to work with. Mark, I know some of the CARES Act extended unemployment to self-employed workers, I believe. But in general, Rebecca worried about overspending on unemployment there, first of all.
So look, $600 in additional weekly unemployment benefits actually is ridiculous. It means that the average person on unemployment for that period was getting about 140% as much unemployment as on work. It didn't end up being very harmful for the economy because this only happened through July. Most of that period we were in lockdown, but I think everyone agrees that was too much. What we're paying right now is unemployment plus 300. And I think that's reasonable for a pandemic economy. It means the average worker is getting about as much on unemployment, slightly less as in their jobs. This House bill would boost that up to 400. I frankly think that's the wrong direction. What we should be doing is extending unemployment to help those that need it, but tapering that down over time as more and more jobs become available.
Rebecca, thanks for that call. Rebecca also concerned about foreign aid as part of our deficit. How big a factor is money spent in other countries, Mark?
So in a typical year, foreign aid is about 2% of the budget, and about half of that is really military. So in terms of what you'd actually think of as aid is more like 1%. It's not large relative to the whole. That doesn't mean that it shouldn't be scrutinized. Every part of the budget deserves scrutiny. We should spend it well. But it's not a major part of the overall budget.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Vernon now in Lake Geneva. Vernon, hi.
Hi. Most of the area that I'm in is a resort community. All of the restaurants, all of the facilities have been shut down or limited. Come summer, if this stays this way, these are all lake communities as resorts. And how do the businesses like ours in the restaurants come back up with money when nobody walks in the door to buy a sandwich or to buy an ice cream cone?
Vernon, thanks a lot for the call. I want to throw that to Mark. Mark, there's been concern that, okay, yes, we had help for businesses to get them through the PPP and other programs like that. Vernon worried that some of the hardest hit businesses there, resorts and restaurants, not getting enough of the support they need, not getting the targeted support they need. What do you think?
Yeah, so back in last spring, we had a program called the Paycheck Protection Program that basically gave money to any small or moderate sized business. It was pretty indiscriminate. And at the time, frankly, every business was basically at threat. As it turns out, most businesses have been able to survive and make it through this pandemic okay. The exception being businesses that are really directly affected by the pandemic, the restaurant industry being the biggest example, restaurant and travel. We had a second round of PPP that is still going out. It actually, while the original benefit offered 10 weeks worth of payroll, This one offers about 14 weeks so for restaurants. So restaurants do get a little bit of that extra in the second PPP. I'm hopeful, I'm an optimist, that with the vaccines, that come springtime and summer, restaurants are going to be really able to have very vibrant outdoor dining and indoor dining. And the second round of PPP is going to be enough for them. But just in case it's not, this new bill making its way through the House does have an additional pot of money for restaurants. And there's other options as well, including some SBA loans. So not every restaurant is going to make it, sadly, but I am optimistic that the total level of support is going to be enough, along with a quick recovery as more of us get vaccinated.
Vernon, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Mark Goldwine from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at our annual deficit in the United States. Big last year, projected to be big again this year. Back to your calls now. Frank is with us in Door County. Frank, hi.
Hello. I have a question concerning the tax cut that took place in the former administration, for which did not help me, but it helped some people who were at the upper end of the tier. I'm wondering what difference that has made. There were projections that over a 10-year period, if we hit certain markers in our growth, that would equal out and be just fine. Now, we weren't hitting those markers before the pandemic. I don't think we hit one quarter. So what deficit situation did that put us in going into a pandemic? And would it be like, would it be likely that we would see an overturn of that? I doubt it. It's not a popular thing to do. It's always popular to cut taxes. However, that is, to me, a large part of the problem we got ourselves into.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. That's 2017, I think, Mark, that had passed. And yeah, the argument was, yes, it's cutting taxes, it's cutting revenue, but it'll boost the economy. And that will ultimately boost the revenue, make it almost revenue neutral. Again, COVID interfered with that, obviously, but how did that pan out from what we had seen up to that point?
Look, I don't know if any real-world examples of a tax cut paying for itself. There's a theoretical case it could, but it doesn't happen in reality except for in very specific circumstances, and this wasn't one of them. Because of the pandemic, there's so many other factors. We can't tell exactly how much this tax cut cost. But the estimates from Congressional Budget Office and others were that even after the economic boost, it would still cost $2 trillion over 10 years, which is tremendous. And by the way, I should add, after we pass those tax cuts, you know, the theory is you cut taxes and that'll force you to cut spending. But after we pass tax cuts on a partisan basis, we then agreed on a bipartisan basis to boost defense and non-defense spending by almost another $2 trillion. And so we came into this pandemic having just added $4 trillion to the 10-year deficit, plus now another $4 trillion of pandemic spending, plus another $2 trillion on its way, plus I don't even know what's going to happen with infrastructure less. It seems like in both parties, the only direction they know how to go is up, is more and more deficits.
Thanks for that call. Roy joins us next in Milwaukee. Roy, hi.
Hi. Like the previous caller, I'm concerned about the tax revenue side of things, and especially long term. And I wonder if you've run an analysis to get a handle on how tax rates for individuals and corporations would have to be adjusted upwards. What would it take to put us in a responsible position with respect to deficits?
Roy, thanks for the call. Possible tax increases is part of our solution, Mark.
Tax increases have to be part of the solution. I think it's really difficult to do the solution 100% on the tax rate side, both because our spending is continuing to grow rapidly with healthcare costs and retirement, but also because there is some limit where as you start to raise rates too much, it creates a lot of sort of escape valves within the economy. And so we're better off probably doing a combination of rates, but also broadening the tax base, looking for loopholes and deductions that we can close. I think a place should all agree where we can start is let's at least collect the taxes that we're owed. Right now, there's a huge tax gap, a huge amount of money that individuals, small businesses, and corporations owe that they aren't paying. We should start by at least making sure that people pay what they owe in current taxes.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mark, and I think I've run this by you before, it seems pretty common for politicians to worry about deficits when the other party is in power. And then when their party's in power, they get to do their own agenda. They don't worry about it so much. With that political landscape, are you skeptical that anybody's going to really tackle these issues?
I'm worried that we're not going to tackle them before it's too late. I have some hope. I think the trust funds provide an opportunity. I think the fact that there are policies that can lower healthcare costs for everyone, including the federal government, creates some opportunity. But I'm very worried that politicians will keep ignoring this, again, except for as sort of a cudgel when they're in the minority, that they will keep ignoring this until it's too late.
And then with this COVID relief package in the news this week in Congress over the next few weeks now, it seems in a lot of ways like Democrats are locked in on this $1.9 trillion package that you support parts of. You're worried that other parts are unnecessary or not very effective ways to spend the money. Do you think there's still an opportunity to tweak that?
I think there is for sure an opportunity to tweak it. First of all, we don't know which parts of this is actually going to be compliant with Senate rules, the so-called Byrd rule. But I also think different senators are going to have different opinions. And so there will be tweaks. The question is how significant they are. If I could do maybe just one thing to this bill, it would be to get rid of this unemployment. Right now, it boosts unemployment benefits, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and then cuts them off completely at the end of August. If instead of boosting them, we can sort of keep them at their current level and then taper them down, but extend them, say, through the end of the year, I think that would make a big difference because there's still going to be a lot of joblessness at the end of August. And I think to just cut it off completely would be really hurtful to a lot of people.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Goldwine is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We talked to him today about the federal deficit. The Congressional Budget Office is projecting a $2.3 trillion deficit this year before President Biden's $1.9 trillion spending bill. Coming up, our next guest says our ideas about what we want in a romantic partner might not actually be the best for us. Find out how science can make us better at dating and building relationships that last. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, America's new defense secretary ordered all units to stand down and address extremism in the ranks. Now that we know that many of those involved in the Capitol riot had ties to the military, are those in charge able to fix the problem? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now you might follow a plan to save money for the future or a path to eventually make it to your dream job. But have you ever considered the step-by-step process in order to meet your future romantic partner? Our next guest says that great relationships don't just happen, they're built with a series of good decisions, and we have to learn the skills to make those decisions. If you're stuck looking for your perfect partner, waiting to feel that spark, or overwhelmed by even getting started in today's dating world, you're not alone. You can join in at 800-642-1234, whether you're dating, not dating, partnered or not. Where do you feel stuck when it comes to modern dating? Is there something you wish you'd understood early on in the process? Do you go on second dates, like our guest recommends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Logan Ury is a behavioral scientist and dating coach, director of relationship science at the dating app Hinge. Her new book is called How to Not Die Alone, the surprising science that will help you find love. Logan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm not dating. I'm married, have been for a long time. And when I look at people who are dating, I'm really glad I'm not. It looks really hard to me. Am I right? Is this a tough time to be out there trying to find love?
Yes, definitely. I hear that from a lot of people. People who haven't used the app say, you know, it looks like it would be fun in the beginning, but that it would get old quickly. And I definitely agree. And so the first chapter of my book is called Why Dating is Harder Now Than Ever Before. And it's exactly about that. We have higher expectations than ever. We have this idea of the paradox of choice, so many different people to choose from. We put so much pressure on ourselves to define our lives by the person we marry. And so the dating apps make it easier in some ways to find someone, but they also make it harder to choose who to actually invest in.
And you write about a tension here that a lot of people will think about when they hear your advice. You're saying, let's apply lessons from behavioral science. Let's understand ourselves and be rational in some ways in our search for love. And a lot of people think, no, that's not how you do it. It's love. It's supposed to just happen. Convince them.
Yes, exactly. So while love is a natural instinct and love is organic and we are born knowing how to love, we are not necessarily born knowing how to date. And dating, as we know it, is relatively new in the span of human history. And dating apps, well, they're only a decade old. And so dating is a skill and dating is something that can be taught. And that's why in the book, I pull the best from behavioral science, the study of how we make decisions, and the best from relationship science, what we know about how love works.
And a big first step you go to is trying to understand where we go wrong. And we go wrong as individuals in different ways. One of them I was just kind of hinting toward the true romantic idea, the idea that we're going to find our love, the magical spark will happen. And that's got to be tempting because so many of our movies prove that that's exactly how it works.
Yes, exactly. That is one of the biggest problems I've seen. So I've identified these dating blind spots that hold people back from finding love, but that they can't identify on their own. And there's three main types. I call them the three dating tendencies. And each of them suffers from unrealistic expectations. And so the first one, kind of what you're referring to, the romanticizer, that's that person who loves soulmates, loves, feels like someone's just going to pop up at the farmer's market and they're going to fall into love and happily ever after. And they have unrealistic expectations of relationships.
That's one of the types. And then there's another one where, we feel like, well, you know what? I'm not really a big catch right now. Maybe someday I'll be ready to date, but who's going to want to date me? Talk about that pratfall and why we shouldn't let it hold us back.
Yeah, so that one is the hesitator. And these are people who have unrealistic expectations of themselves. And they believe that love is conditional. And sadly, they just believe that they're not lovable yet. And so their frame is, I'll be ready to date when I lose 10 pounds, when I have a more impressive job, when I have money saved in the bank. And they always feel like one day they'll wake up and then magically be ready to date. But the truth is, I'm imperfect. You're imperfect. The person that you're going to wind up with is imperfect. And nobody just magically knows how to date. You actually have to get out there, get better at dating. Dating is a skill. Figure out who you want to be with. And so for those people, the hesitators, I say, don't wait, date.
Now there's the romanticizer, the hesitator, and then the third common type, the maximizer. And you mentioned that phrase, the paradox of choice. So how does that play out for the maximizer?
Yes. Well, I believe that many people are maximizers, especially as a dating coach, the type of people that find me. And so maximizers have unrealistic expectations of their partners. And these are the people who believe in grass is always greener. They're always wondering who else is out there. And I've really had dating coaching clients who say, you know, I like my girlfriend, but could I be 5% happier with somebody else? And they're so obsessed with finding the perfect person. They don't understand that so much of what makes a great relationship is finding somebody and then building it. It's not just finding a perfect person and then it'll be effortless.
We're talking to Logan Urie about the modern world of dating. Her new book is called How to Not Die Alone, The Surprising Science That Will Help You Find Love. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences in trying to date, trying to build a relationship in the modern era, maybe especially during COVID. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Dating apps, love them, hate them. Got to use them anyway. 800-642-1234. Logan, these dating apps, they've changed the game for a lot of people. Not necessarily, I think people think, for the better. What kind of advice do you offer people who are thinking, okay, maybe I got to try these things?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that there was a stigma around online dating for a while, and people would pretend that they had met at a bar and not online. But what we know with research from Stanford, from Michael J. Rosenfeld, is that even before the pandemic, starting around 2018, met online was the number one way that people had met. And that outsourced things like met at work or met through family and friends. So if you are somebody who's waiting to try a dating app, just understand this is how many people are dating nowadays, especially during the pandemic. And people put too much pressure on these things. Oh, I have to represent myself with a profile and I have to match. Just think about it as a modern matchmaker. This is how people are meeting nowadays. But once you get onto that date, it's the same as a relationship as if you had met elsewhere.
One piece of advice you offer here actually kind of feeds into even not online dating, and that's be really careful how you set your parameters. I guess you could pick your preferred height. And so you might pick 5'10". Well, what if there's this great person out there who's 5'9½", and you never see them because of that, right? I saw one case where a couple met, they'd set their maximum distance apart for 100 miles. They happened to live 99 miles apart and thought, what if one of us lived two blocks further that way? We never would have met. How can we be careful not to screen out people for not great reasons?
Oh, yes. This is such a great example. And I'll tell a personal story, which is that my now husband, I saw him on Tinder about 2 years before we started dating. And I just totally misjudged him, didn't think we'd be a good match, and swiped left on him. And now we're happily married. And I'm so glad that we are. And so I think part of this is that we think that we can read between the lines, that we can get so much from somebody's profile. But honestly, a lot of the stuff that matters is what side of you the person brings out, how you feel when you're around them. And so in the end, things like height or geographic region or age, they just matter less than we think we do. And so anybody listening out there who's using a dating app, I would really encourage you to go into your app and see, can you broaden your parameters? Can you date someone a little bit older, a little bit younger, a little shorter, a little taller? Can you actually consider that you should date like a scientist and that you might be wrong about the type of person who will make you happiest long term, and that many people find love when they give up their type?
Yeah, how do we do that? Because you say we can measure, we can put a number on a height or an income or whatever like that. How do we evaluate, and again, on or offline, how do we evaluate the things that are really going to matter but are intangible? You can't slap a number on them.
Yes, this was one of my favorite chapters in the book, is exploring what matters more and less than we think for long-term relationships. And so the list of things that matters less than we think, so, you know, they matter, but not as much as some people put pressure on them. These are things like looks and similar personalities, money, shared hobbies. And people, you know, they break up with people all the time. Oh, I'm an introvert, he's an extrovert, it's never going to work. But the research just doesn't support that. And the things that matter more than people often think about are things like having a growth mindset, somebody who believes that they can develop skills, that they can get better over time, somebody who's kind, loyal, emotionally stable, someone with whom you can make hard decisions. And finally, what has become the most important one to me, what side of you they bring out. And so, yes, it does take time. You can't necessarily look at somebody's profile and say, are they loyal and are they emotionally stable? But there are things that you can use to look at that as a proxy. For example, is this the type of person who helps their friend move? Is this the type of person who has friends from all parts of their life? Is this a person who takes time to respond and doesn't just react? And so really focusing on the things that matter and not saying no to people for the things that don't.
We're talking to Logan Urie. Her new book is called How to Not Die Alone, The Surprising Science That Will Help You Find Love. We're talking about the modern world of dating and building relationships. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been dating during the pandemic, maybe even trying video dates? Did you meet someone online? Is the world of dating these days confounding to you? Do you need some advice? Do you have a success story to share or otherwise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Logan Urie, author of the new book, How to Not Die Alone, The Surprising Science That Will Help You Find Love. She's a behavior scientist turned dating coach and director of relationship science at the dating app Hinge. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your stories of dating in the 21st century and maybe your questions. Tell us what worked for you, what doesn't work for you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. I want to know what the trick is. I've been on and off dating sites for quite a number of years, and now I'm getting to the point where I really would like to find somebody to spend the rest of my life with. And I see a lot of women that have been on there for years, and they're perfect, and, you know, you read their profiles, and you write to them, and I get just about no responses when I write to somebody. And I understand that women get a lot more responses than guys do. What is the trick for a guy? What is a guy supposed to do, and what are these women really looking for?
Dave, thanks for the call. Advice on how to get first bit of attention on a dating site, Logan.
Yeah, so the first thing that I would say is really investing in your profile. You want to make sure that you're putting your best foot forward. And some of these things may seem obvious, but I've seen people make a lot of mistakes with them. So just making sure your first picture is really strong, that it shows who you are. Using a mixture of humor and vulnerability. That's something in our research at Hinge that we found that people are really looking for. They want to see a silly side of you. They also want to see an earnest side. They want to see what you're looking for. They want to see what you're interested in. And so really your profile is your opening line because it's showing people what you're all about. The second thing I would say is, what are you putting in these messages? And you really want to show someone that you've invested time in looking at their profile and you've thought of a creative question. So many times people say things like, hey, what's up? Or hey, how was your weekend? But is there something unique that you can do? Can you make a comment about a picture that they have from a trip that they took? Can you ask them a specific question about a hobby that they've expressed? And what I would say is sending fewer, better messages is often the key. It's all about showing somebody that you've put that effort in. And to your last question, what are women really looking for? Well, that is an age-old question. But one thing I will add to that is that so often people are focused on being interesting. And I think the trick is really to make the other person feel interesting and for you to be interested. And so what can you do to invest in being a better listener? How can you show someone that you care? And how can you really put that effort into the early messages? Good luck.
Dave, thanks for the call and good luck. Mark joins us now in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey, friend. So my wife and I met on Match.com. I had decided that I was a really good single guy and I was done. So I closed up my account, stopped paying the money, the whole thing, done. My wife, on the other hand, was 2 hours away and she did not want a long distance relationship. Somehow my profile that was supposed to be closed showed up in her account. She took a chance. 16 years later, most days we're pretty happy.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So Mark had given up, I get the remnant of his profile caught somebody's eye too far away. Yeah, in both of those cases, they both had a reason to not pursue the other one. Too far away, gave up on dating altogether. They still did it, Logan.
I love that story. I hope that that's inspiration for everyone listening, because so often we have these checklists and as we get older, we get more and more sure that we know exactly what we want. But it is often when we loosen our parameters, when we get a little bit more forgiving around things like age, height, and location, that we really find someone who makes us happy. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Thanks a lot for that call. And he mentioned something that made me think of something later in your book, Logan. He said 16 years married, mostly happy or happy most days. Mm-hmm. And you write that, you know what, just because something clicks right off the bat doesn't mean happily ever after. What kind of attitudes can we take into a relationship in the long term to, you know, roll with changes and grow together?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Well, one of the biggest problems that I've seen in my research of modern relationships is that people sort of have this set it and forget it attitude. You think the hard work of love is finding someone and then it'll be easy, but that's unfortunately just not the case. And so the best advice I have for this is from Dr. John Gottman, who some people might be familiar with from the Gottman Institute. And he says small things often, that really great relationships are built every day. It's by paying attention to your partner, paying attention when they're trying to connect with you, and understanding that relationships are long, the people in them are going to change over time, and you need to be adaptable and you need to invest every day to make that relationship last.
Logan Urie is with us. Her new book is called How to Not Die Alone, The Surprising Science That Will Help You Find Love. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Travis is with us now in Waukesha. Travis, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Logan, thanks for being here. I mean, I wasn't even expecting this kind of topic on WPR, but I appreciate it. I guess My question goes, do you think that the market for, like, personal dating coaches or, like, matchmaking services has decreased since the uses of apps? I mean, me personally, about 2 years ago, I don't want to say I was desperate, but I was really looking for someone, and apps just weren't doing it for me. And I invested, honestly, $7,000 into a matchmaking service. And in, like, hindsight now, I regret doing that because it really didn't help me at all. It was four blind dates is basically all it was for me, so.
Interesting, Travis.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I was going to say that's such an interesting question. The first thing that came to mind when you asked it is the fact that during the pandemic, people are really stressed. There's high amounts of anxiety. Pair that with the anxiety of finding somebody. And I know that therapists are booked. Every good therapist that I know in the Bay Area where I'm based is completely booked up. And so in general, I think that this is a really hard time for people and people are seeking out help. So in general, when it comes to mental health professionals, I feel like the last year at least, people's books are really filling up. It's an interesting question that you bring up about how have dating apps changed things like dating coaches and matchmakers. I don't have information on that, but I would say there's definitely a group of people who are experiencing dating app burnout who feel like for whatever reason, dating apps aren't the best fit for them. And so for people like that, getting help with their profile, getting help with swiping, getting help with matchmaking, that has been useful for some people. But I'll end by saying, sometimes what's holding somebody back is not about meeting the right person. It's about how they're showing up. And so for anyone in that situation, I'd say, if you feel like you're putting in the effort and it's still not working, what else could be holding you back? And how can you actually figure out, well, this is my pattern. And it doesn't have to do with meeting someone. It has to do with how I'm showing up.
Thanks a lot for that call, Travis, and good luck to you. Let's go to Anne next in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. My question is about men on these apps who are shorter than average. I have a friend who is 5'4", and he feels that it's really tough because many women look for taller men. So how do you get over these biases or these parameters?
And thanks for that call. And there's that person who maybe got screened out by somebody's arbitrary selection right up front, Logan.
Oh, yes. And I'll mention one stat from the book that people bring up to me a lot. And so in general, you know, people care about height and women care about height. But what Dan Ariely found in his research is that for a man who's 5'9 to be seen as equally attractive on a certain dating site as a man who's 5'10, that 5'9 guy needed to make $40,000 or more per year in order to be seen as equally attractive. And so I just want to start by saying your friend is definitely not alone. There is a lot of height discrimination happening on the apps, not because height matters so much, but just because whatever we can measure is what ends up mattering. And so just want to say, I really feel for your friend, and that's something that is common. And so just one thing that I would encourage that person to do is to see what are the other places where he can meet people? What are the events that he can go to, even the online ones? How can he ask his friends to set him up? What are local community spots like a dog park where he can meet people? And so sometimes it's just understanding that maybe the dating apps are not working for you right now and just exploring how can you actually see who's in your network beyond the online community and actually turn that into a great relationship.
Thanks for the call, Anne. Let's spend our last minute or so, Logan, talking about when we can do stuff in person a lot again, hopefully very soon. Leave us with a bit of advice on, okay, you got the date. How do we make the most of it?
Yes. My whole thing is that this is a date, not a job interview. And we should be making dates way more fun. And you should be designing dates that lead to connection. And so that means inserting an element of play. Can you meet up in a park and run around and pet 5 dogs? Can you make up a game? Can you sit on a bench and pretend to narrate what the people around you are saying? And really, dates should be experiences. They should lead to connection. You should skip the small talk. And so if it feels like a job interview where you're just interrogating somebody, you're doing it wrong. Go on fewer, better dates and really work hard to make them fun.
And briefly, Logan, I think a big part of your message is don't give up hope. With some rethinking and new approaches, things that haven't been working could start working.
Absolutely. So many people are emailing me saying, I thought there was something wrong with me, but it sounds like a lot of people have these problems. And it's true. You might have some bad patterns that are holding you back, but a great relationship is the culmination of good decisions. And so just make some different decisions along the way. And I think you'll be very surprised to see where you wind up.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Logan.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Logan Urie is a behavioral scientist turned dating coach, the director of relationship science at the dating app Hinge. We've been talking about her new book. It's called How to Not Die Alone, the surprising science that will help you find love. Hey, if you still have a story to share, maybe about how you successfully found someone, I think people could use some inspiration. You can share that with us over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, the head of the U.S. Postal Service answered questions and criticism from a congressional committee this week. Kate and her guest look at challenges facing the post office and possible cuts in service. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a physician makes the case that progress with COVID vaccines could bring life back to normal sooner than we might think. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.